Tantor Audio presents Paris Letters by Janice McLeod. Narrated by Tavia Gilbert. As you move toward a dream, the dream moves toward you. Julia Cameron, The Artist's Way. 1. We met at a cafe in Paris. "I'm in love with the butcher," I told Summer. We were sitting outside Shakespeare and Company, an English bookstore on the left bank, just beyond the shadow of Notre Dame Cathedral in Paris.
"That was fast. I thought you were vegan."
"I was. I am. But I'm in Paris." Paris, it seems, was the beginning of letting go of who I was and grabbing hold of who I was to become. It was the spring of 2011. I had recently left my job and my life in Los Angeles and booked 3 months to traipse around Europe. 6 weeks in Paris, 3 weeks in the United Kingdom, the rest in Italy.
"Is he in love with you, too?" she asked.
"We haven't spoken." I hesitated. "But the other day, when I ordered my coffee at the cafe across from his shop, we locked eyes. Yesterday, when I walked by, I said bonjour, and he said bonjour back. And this morning, I said the same, and he replied with bonjour, mademoiselle."
"Progress!"
She laughed and slapped my shoulder like she was my oldest and dearest friend, instead of what she really was, someone I met at the airport baggage claim at Charles de Gaulle a few days before. Summer had approached me and asked if I'd ever taken the train to the city center. I said I hadn't, but I was going to figure it out. She grabbed her bag off the belt and said she'd follow me. After an hour on the train, we had decided to spend a few days navigating our way around Paris together during the week she was here. Paris was a big town, and it would be nice to have someone with whom I could get my bearings. She had a loud, raspy roughness about her that made me wince. But even the ones you don't like, you like better in Paris. When you travel, you release the usual hang-ups because you need to cling together in the face of a foreign culture. Making friends on the road is a mix of sympathy and surrender. This friend looked like she had always been on the Blonde Ambition tour. Her long blonde extensions fell perfectly down her back. Her big blue eyes were topped with long eyelash extensions, and her lip gloss glistened in the warm spring sunshine.
"Why don't you talk to him?" she asked, as we perused Les Livres on the sales rack outside the bookstore.
She wanted to buy a book and get it stamped with the bookstore's famous logo as a souvenir.
"No way. What if he speaks French back? If he said more than bonjour, mademoiselle, to me, I'd stare back with my tongue in knots."
I was required to take French in elementary school and high school in Canada, but I spoke French to other English-speaking students, and we only read what was in our livre. Here in France, they could say anything, and I was not prepared for anything.
"What does he look like?"
She was flipping through a French cookbook. My butcher boyfriend bore a striking resemblance to Daniel Craig. He had light brown hair and the blue eyes of mystics and madmen. His striped shirt was rolled up past his elbows, revealing the beginning of a tattoo. Each morning he would lift a spit of chickens from the top of the rotisserie and lean it against the table. He slid them off one by one with a long fork, piling them in a pyramid on the warmer. He and his sexy jeans would then bend down to stir up the potatoes that were roasting in drippings at the bottom of the oven. When that was done, he would stand up, lean against the wall, look my way, and smile. I felt steam.
"So do I," Summer said, fanning herself. "Where is this cafe?"
It was on Rue Mouffetard, the city's oldest market street. From there, I could watch the parade of people and pooches picking up morsels from each shop along the cobblestone street. In one direction, I spotted 2 wine shops, 2 fish shops, and a fruit market. In the other direction, 2 bakeries, 2 bistros, and another fruit market. And directly across from me, a butcher shop featuring a blue-eyed James Bond.
can't talk to him, I said. I could hardly even order a coffee in French. On my first morning at the cafe, the waiter came by to take my order. Café latte, s'il vous plaît, I sputtered. Café crème, he corrected. I nodded and blushed. This would be my first of thousands of linguistic corrections in Paris. A café latte is about the same as a café crème, but this isn't Italy or Starbucks. Steve Martin once joked that the French have a different word for everything, and here it's not latte, it's crème. Sitting with my crème, I pulled out my journal to write. It was March 2011, and I had been keeping a daily journal for the last 14 months. But on this day, for the first time, I had nothing to write. I looked up at the butcher. He looked over at me. I blushed. He did not. I picked up my pen and began, "Dear Monsieur Boucher, I wish I could speak French. I would ask you many questions. How did you come to stand outside La Boucherie all day selling chickens? Do your feet get tired? Your back? Your arms? How do you keep your mind occupied? How do you feel about everyone walking along and you staying in one spot? When you look down at your phone, are you looking for a text from a girl? Where do you go at the end of the day? Are you going to meet her? Has anyone ever told you that you look like Daniel Craig? I imagine that you follow a sports team passionately, and that the friends you have are friends you've had for life. I imagine they are good people. You seem like a good person. I watch you smile at children. You lean down to hear little old ladies. You shake hands with men. You check me out. I wish you could sit with me here at the cafe. You would speak French, I would speak English. We would not understand each other, but we would grin and offer up sheepish smiles. We could take a lifetime to piece together a conversation. It would be nice. Bonsoir, mon ami mystérieux. Janice.
You wrote the butcher a letter? Said Summer.
We were squeezing our way through the crowded bookstore.
Did you give it to him?
I shook my head. Instead of giving him the letter, I had tucked it into my purse, paid for my coffee, and struck out for the day.
Give it to him. You could score 2 weeks of kisses along the Seine, she said.
Isn't that what you're here for?
That's why I'm here. I'd love a little French romance on my Parisian adventure.
My plan here in Paris sounded lame by comparison. I was here to take pretty photos for my blog and to warm up my language skills. 3 days in, I was able to order my crème with my waiter and say bonjour to the butcher. Progress? I sighed. We don't even speak the same language. It would end like it always ends.
Or not, she said.
I hadn't considered that option before, that it could not end. I thought of my letter. I didn't know at the time that the letter full of questions for the butcher would lead to a lot of answers. Books were piled to the rafters and in messy stacks along the stairs. Some were new, most were gently used, according to the sticker on the bindings. Sometimes you could even pick up an old book and discover that it had been signed by the author to George Whitman, the original owner of the store. George found himself in Paris after World War II. He hadn't been too eager to return to America, so he enrolled at the Sorbonne University to study French. During his studies, he had amassed a rather large collection of English books. If you've ever studied language in a foreign country, you know that you should immerse yourself fully and turn away from your mother tongue in order to get the new language to stick in your head. But what often happens is that you become even more eager to read books in your own language, find friends of your own language, and do all you can to rest your brain from the mental push-ups of learning the new language. Eventually, George had amassed so many English books that he decided to open an English bookstore. He soon expanded to Digs on the Bank of the Seine, where it sits today,
welcoming rebelling French language students and English writers for over 50 years. Summer bought a book about the history of burlesque in Paris. I thought back to the butcher and bought a French-English dictionary. 2. How much money does it take to quit your job? Before I arrived in Paris, I was living in California, working as a copywriter in an advertising agency. I was 34, single, lonely, feeling unfulfilled by my job and on the brink of burnout. Something had to change. I wanted to be an artist, someone who could make a great living creating something lovely. So I made a New Year's resolution in January 2010 to do just that. In Julia Cameron's book, The Artist's Way, she details how to become an artist. One of her instructions is to write 3 pages a day in a journal and the answers will come. She explains that in writing, many changes will be set in motion. Chief among them will be the triggering of synchronicity. We change and the universe furthers and expands that change. She continues with a note, which excited and frightened me in equal measure. Leap, and the net will appear. So I started writing in my journal, 3 pages a day for a year. I also started a blog so I would be accountable to an invisible populace. We would discover together if writing 3 pages a day in a journal could turn me into an artist. It was a small leap, but it gave me hope that I could change my life, or at least enhance it. Really, I just wanted to create something that made me feel good, because what I was currently creating definitely did not. I wrote junk mail. I wrote the garbage that goes straight from the mailbox to the recycling box. No flashy car commercials for me, no hip billboards. Nope, I wrote true junk mail. I mucked up websites with ads, stuffed bills with flyers, and inundated the public with information on products they probably didn't care about and likely never asked for. That was me, mailing out perfect forest after perfect forest of perfectly useless messages from Fortune 500 companies. I was directly involved with the noise of daily life. You know that letter you received from the car insurance company about how you could save big if you switched now? That was me. And the one from your phone company that told you if you upgraded to a family plan, everyone would save? That was me, too. And those extra slips of advertising in your electric bill, gas bill, and credit card bill? Me, me, and me. I'm not a fan of this legacy of garbage, but as my colleague Jeff always reminded me, the checks cleared. Copywriting gave me 2 things I loved: those checks and something impressive to say about my career at parties. Everyone thinks advertising is slick, but it's only slick in a greasy kind of way. Sure, on occasion I had the chance to do a fun TV spot, but TV spots are big-budget endeavors, and with the stock market decline of 2007 followed by the flailing economy, companies were going for cheaper modes of getting the word out. Direct mail. During the first month of writing in my journal, I had a lot of questions about how I had become so miserable with my life. On the surface, everything looked fine. I was making a decent living. I had an apartment in Santa Monica with 2 parking spots, which is a big deal if you live in Southern California, and I had a nice handful of friends. Life should have felt great. I had just turned 34 and was hanging out on a rung near the top of the corporate ladder. But it started to dawn on me that my ladder was leaning against the wrong wall. How did this happen? One question swirled in my head and finally fell onto the page. Whose dream life am I living? Because it's certainly not mine. I scanned through the history of my decisions for clues on how I arrived at this place. Immediately, I had the unpleasant realization that I was, in fact, living my dream life, but it was a dream life I had created after I graduated university when I didn't know any better. I grew up. My dreams did not.
Back then, more than anything, I had wanted to be a copywriter. And once I started working in an advertising agency, I learned I had a talent for it. I worked my way up to middle management, which afforded me middle management luxuries. I couldn't afford to buy a house, but I could afford an apartment in Santa Monica. Not beachfront, but beachfront adjacent. And yet, after a decade, I was drained and miserable, and I knew I couldn't fulfill this dream for the long haul. At the beginning of my advertising career, someone had mentioned that it's easy to burn out. I thought this was crazy talk. At the time, I had just started writing the inserts that went into the phone bill, which, in advertising hierarchy, was considered a step up from writing the back of cereal boxes. I thought I had hit the big time, or was well on my way to writing print ads and car commercials. Maybe one day I'd get the holy grail of advertising, a Super Bowl spot. Awards, accolades, and raises poured in. Well, they didn't pour in, but there was a consistent trickle, and I loved every bit of it. But after the millionth headline and billionth copy change, I couldn't use advertising to burn through my creative juices anymore. I was on autopilot. If writing direct mail wasn't helping to get my creative energy out, I figured I'd have to burn it up in an artistic endeavor. But what? Up until then, I had dabbled in photography, jewelry making, painting, collage, guitar, and even bookbinding. But like most New Year's resolutions, my enthusiasm for these pursuits waned, and I was left once again with plenty of creative energy but no outlet. Could I just get another job at another agency? No, that wasn't a solution. I had been in enough agencies at this point to know, as they say in Paris, same merde, different pile. And honestly, if I had to work in an advertising agency, the agency I was at was as good as any other. In fact, it was probably better than most, except for the staggering number of status meetings and the meager 2-week vacation policy. But there were free snacks in the kitchen, and as many post-it notes as I wanted. I should have been spending my time being grateful. Perhaps all I really needed was another vacation. Not some grand journal-writing experiment, not to become an artist. Or maybe what I needed was a boyfriend. More yoga, more kale, therapy, meditation. It was probably just because I am a Capricorn. I could blame my parents for that one. In fact, I could probably blame them for everything. Or karma. My knees, the golf balls of knots running down my back, my mouthful of mercury fillings, my sisters, my ex-boyfriends. Who else could I blame? Let's get this party started. No. Blaming people, places, or things wasn't going to serve me on the road ahead. By the second month of my year of journaling, I had used reams of paper to offload my gripes about work. It didn't feel like any answers were coming, as Julia Cameron had promised. And yet, in a way, they were. By the end of February, as I literally saw before my very eyes just how much I complained about my job, a question was revealed. A question that had never occurred to me before. A question that was so juicy that I immediately abandoned the pursuit of becoming an artist. A question so startlingly simple that I am still astounded that I didn't think of it before. At the end of yet another 3 pages of complaining about work, I sighed and wrote this question. How much money does it take to quit your job? I asked my colleague, Akemi. We were sitting in her office, picking through our salads. I don't know, more than I've got, she said, scrounging at the bottom of her cardboard box for bacon bits. Plenty. Maybe $1 million. It would take me forever to make $1 million. I'm talking about buying yourself a buffer of time so you can quit your job and figure out something else to do. We contemplated in silence for a minute, letting this question swirl. She set down her salad. It depends on how much money you spend in a day. Multiply that by how many days you don't want to work. Save up that amount. Easy. I set down my salad, astounded at the simplicity of this. It's like saving up to buy yourself your own sabbatical, I said.
Exactly.
How much do you spend in a day?
I have no idea, she admitted.
Me neither.
Say you spend $100 a day. That includes rent, gas, food, everything. You'd have to save $36,500 to live the same way for a year without work.
And use that year to figure out a way to buy yourself another year.
And so on.
And so forth.
She picked up her salad.
But what would you do with your time? She asked.
You're a copywriter. That's who you are.
Her eyes narrowed.
Is this about the vacation policy?
Maybe, I replied.
I swallowed hard on my kale. I was the official office griper about how little vacation time we were given. A mere non-negotiable 2 weeks. I griped so loudly and so often that my boss hung a giant calendar on the wall outside my office and would mark down all the approved vacation time for everyone to see and for me to stare at from my office. While I worked my way through the pile of folders that came and went in my office, a folder parade, if you will, I could peer through the glass and watch her conduct her vacation policy parade. She would walk over to the calendar with my nervous colleagues in tow, their vacation request forms shaking in their hands. She'd point at the calendar.
See here, there are already 2 art directors out that week. We need you in the office.
Dejected and without a worthy comeback, they'd slink away, Charlie Brown style, cancel the plane tickets they'd already bought, take a few Tums, and come over to my office to process what just happened. I had tissues, a loathing for the vacation policy, and a master's degree in counseling, so they knew they were in a safe place to talk. They'd vent, I'd nod in agreement, they'd vent more, I'd nod more. I'd tell them where they had gone wrong and how they could improve their strategy for next time.
See here? I'd point at their rejected vacation request form.
When you wanted 8 vacation days but you only accrued 4, you can only pull that off with the help of a public holiday. Plus, don't think about tacking on sick days. If you do that, you won't get paid for any of them.
Their eyes would bug out, and they'd stop crying mid-sniffle.
What? I won't get paid?
I would lean back in my desk. It's happened before. I had anecdotes about others who had to cancel flights and work over Christmas, about someone being told they hadn't accrued the time off to attend a funeral.
Me.
About honeymoons reduced or rescheduled. Entire weddings were delayed until enough vacation days had been accrued for the honeymoons. I was a vacation request coach. I always took one of my 2 weeks of vacation in Canada over Christmas to visit family. It would be months before I could take another week of vacation. I had already bought my tickets for Rome the following May and gotten my vacation request form approved. I was on the calendar, which meant my vacation was as good as carved in stone. I started to wonder why I had chosen a life of 20-minute lunch breaks, timesheets, and 2-week annual vacation policies. Akemi's phone buzzed.
An email. Subject, main conference room in 2 minutes. Don't be late. It's from you-know-who.
By the way she jumped up, I knew exactly who it was. Taking her cue, we quickly gathered our containers, tossed them in the trash, and walked to the conference room. Being late would mean being scolded by our supervisor, who would tell us that we had to buck up and pull our weight around here. Then we would slink off and doodle hateful images in the margins of our notebooks.
Spankings, office style.
The big emergency was a surprise office birthday party for what's-his-name. Always awkward. Always necessary. These office birthday parties remind me of other dumb moments in corporate daily life, such as saying hump day when it's Wednesday and one more day when it's Thursday. We ask the same dumb questions. How was your weekend on Mondays and got big plans for the weekend on Fridays? We share tips for how to make the best oatmeal in the office microwave. Use cold water. We send a card around the agency with an envelope for you to throw in your extra bucks for the birthday, wedding shower, baby shower, going away gift. When would it end? Every time I slipped a couple of bucks in an envelope, wrote a pithy comment in a card, or sat through a sad rendition of Happy Birthday, I couldn't help but sigh inwardly and think, this is not my life. After the slick birthday cake from Ralph's big box grocery store, I returned to my office and began writing my daily 3 pages. Today's journal entry took an interesting turn. Instead of griping about office birthday parties, reeling through what I should or shouldn't have said to so-and-so in our disagreement about due dates or about how much I loathed filling out timesheets and permission forms, I thought about what Akemi had said and started writing money equations. This is nothing new. People everywhere are calculating their incoming and their outgoing. They're looking at the numbers and wondering how to make more, save more, buy more, pay off more, make ends meet, or how to have more money left at the end of the month rather than more month left at the end of the money. How much money would it take to quit my job? Could I get by on spending just $100 a day in my future life, including rent, car, bills, food, everything? This number was arbitrary because I didn't know how much I currently spent in a day. All I knew was that I could afford my current life and extras like that trip I was taking to Rome and eating out. But I still had credit card debt. I was still beachfront adjacent. What I liked about her $100 a day equation was that it was easy math. I have a wall in my brain with math. If you ask me a question about an equation, I'll answer it with a blank look. But even I can multiply a number by 100. And this basic math skill was enough to keep my pencil on the paper, fooling with numbers. Say I would have a budget of $100 a day in my future life where I'm not working. If I took 2010 to save $100 a day, I'd have to save $36,500 by the end of the year. I already had some money in savings, but not much. $100 a day is not so impossible. So the preposterous, outrageous, ridiculously large, seemingly unreachable number of $36,500 became just saving or making $100 a day. $100 is something I can imagine quite easily. I can aim for $100 a day just by going to work and saying no to that group lunch or buying that sweater. I could make this happen. I wasn't sure how, but I'd figure that out later. For now, I had to save or make $100 a day. Sitting at my desk with the number 100 staring me in the face, I finally understood what all the journal writing was about. I didn't need to find an artistic pursuit, a hobby, or creative outlet. I needed to figure out how to save up enough to fund my own sabbatical. Or even better, get out of my job. Perhaps even my career. I would create my own Shawshank Redemption. I put down my pen and stared at the number. Forget finding my true art. Forget becoming an artist. I needed to become an escape artist. Dear, your name inserted by a computer bot. Exciting news! It doesn't matter what news it is, I'm going to make it sound exciting. This is where I tell you that there is a great offer, but it's only available for a limited time, so you'd better act now. The first bold subhead is usually a short version of the offer I described in the first paragraph. That's right, I'm going to say it again, because I know you won't read this whole letter, you'll scan it, so I'll sound like a broken record until you call the 1-800 number or visit us online. The second subhead is the first selling proposition. I'll tell you why we're better than the other guys. I'll tell you why we are the biggest, fastest, clearest, safest, and best in the league. And I'll be offering it for the best price, obviously.
Sample complete. Ready to continue?